Bob started by saying, if you look at Matthew 27:46, at first glance, this verse seems to imply that God the Father had forsaken His Son. Well, He said it for me, what I probably said so many times last night that you're sick of it, and that is, if you just take the plain meaning for these passages, then my position is proven true. Bob says, admits that at first glance, this verse seems to prove what I believe about this, that Jesus was forsaken. But Bob is going to have to work and work and work and work to try to get around the plain meaning of that verse. Now, let me ask you, how could one deny, and Alan, I'm resisting getting that pointer since I beat the wall to death last night without realizing. I didn't even realize I was touching it. How could one deny the Father forsook Jesus when Jesus is plainly asking the Father why He did just that? How could you deny that? My son, he doesn't prove anything. My son Joshua, how can you even have a debate on this? It's clear. If Jesus asked the Father why He denied Him, how could Bob deny that? It's just beyond my comprehension. It's so plain. Suppose Tommy and I have been friends for a good long time. Suppose, rightly or wrongly, I felt that Tommy had betrayed a trust or he did something to hurt my feelings. Suppose I asked Tommy, why did you betray me or why did you forsake me? I suggest to you that means one of only three things. Either I'm lying about it, I know he didn't forsake me, didn't betray me, I'm asking him anyway, or I'm mistaken, I think that he did, but he didn't. Or Tommy did forsake me. It's only one of those three options. It's nothing else. Jesus is either lying, he's mistaken, or God the Father forsook him. Now, we know Jesus wasn't lying or mistaken. Now, just to drive this point home, what Bob said, that the plain meaning of this passage teaches my position, let's look at all 31 cases in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John where Jesus asked, why, it's the people usually, but he says, why did you do this? I've got all 31 cases where he says, why did you do this? Now, these you're not going to be able to read, of course not, because I don't have time to go through all of them anyway. But I want us to go through some of the ones that are more familiar to us. But if you want my charts, you'll get to see all 31 and you can have my charts. Jesus said in Matthew 8:26, why are you fearful? Then he rebuked the winds and the sea. Doesn't that mean that imply the disciples were fearful? Doesn't it? Doesn't it imply that when Jesus says, why are you fearful? Doesn't that mean the disciples were fearful? Everybody here in this room agrees that it does. Why? Matthew 19:17. Why callest thou me good? There's none good but one. Doesn't that mean the rich young ruler called Jesus good? We know he did. That's what that means. That's the plain meaning of the passage. It doesn't mean anything else. Why try to get around it? Why would you want to work to try to get around the plain meaning of these passages? Bob, what do you have to gain? When you see a passage that's very plain on something, what do we have to gain by trying to figure out a way to get around it? Matthew 26:10, Jesus said, why trouble you the woman? For she hath wrought a good work in me. Did they trouble her or not? You can tell from that phrase that they did trouble her, can't you? Luke 6:46, and why call you me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? Can't we tell from that, Trevor, that they called him Lord, Lord, but didn't do the things that he said? I think we can. I think there's no doubt about it. Then why should there be any doubt about Matthew 27:46? What about Luke 22:46? Why sleep ye? Rise and pray. And then later he found them sleeping. John 7:19. Why go you about to kill me? Weren't the Pharisees conniving to his death? Matthew 12:14, 26:4 says that they were. Matthew 18:23. If I have spoken well, why smitest thou me? Was Jesus struck? Bob, or was he only noting that Isaiah 53:4 prophesied that the Christ would be smitten? Was he really struck, or was he only calling attention to Isaiah 53? Which one, Bob? You basically said all he's doing in Matthew 27 was calling attention to Psalms 22. Well, what was he doing here? Was he really struck? He says, why smitest thou me? I conclude from that they smote him. What about you guys? Everybody in the audience, ask yourself that question. It's that clear. It's really that easy to determine the truth on this passage. It's just as easy to determine the truth on Matthew 27:46 as it is to determine these. And these are very easy. John 20:15, Jesus said, woman, why weepest thou? Well, she was weeping, wouldn't she? So why would you conclude anything different from Matthew 27:46? My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Everybody in this room, I dare say, every single one of us agrees that Jesus is asking why, that what Jesus is asking why about is true in all 31 cases except in this one instance. And I asked you, why did you conclude differently? All 31 times he asked, why did you do that? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Every time you'll agree with me that they did what he was asking why they did. Yet in Matthew 27:46, when Jesus asked the Father why he forsook him, you don't conclude the same thing that Jesus actually forsook him. It's strange to me that anybody could come to a conclusion that is so opposite of what the Bible so plainly says. Then Bob said, why did Jesus ask why? Bob's argument is basically this. It's in question form. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And surely Jesus knew, if he was forsaken, why Jesus would have forsaken him. Therefore, according to Bob, that proves he wasn't forsaken. Bob, in Matthew 26:39, Jesus said, question, O my Father, if it be... Well, he didn't say a question here, but I'll get to that. O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. Bob, according to your reasoning, that means that Jesus didn't know why he had come to this earth to die. Because Jesus is basically asking the Father, if it's possible, let this cup, this death, pass from me. I don't want to have to do it if I can help it. Is there any other way? According to Bob's logic on Matthew 27:46, that means that Jesus didn't know why he came to this earth. Now, I've been a jogger for many years, and many times when I'm jogging, and I think everybody here who jogs or exercises like that will know this. I ask myself, after about 3 miles, after about 2.5, Jennifer, I'm saying, why am I doing this? Not because I don't know why I'm doing it. I made up my mind a long time ago. Actually, my dad started forcing me to when I was little. Not because I didn't know why or because I would choose differently or even really out of frustration. It's out of pain. I ask, why am I doing this when I'm jogging? It's out of pain. I like the way J.T. Smith explained it in the April 2011 issue of Gospel Truths. Was it because the flesh was in such misery that he cried out from the torment of his situation? And he's talking about Matthew 27:46. I agree with him. He's in misery. So he cries out. Again, the only three viable options are either Jesus was mistaken, Jesus was lying, or Jesus was mistaken. Or Jesus was forsaken. Excuse me. There's one of those bumbles I was talking about, Gary. Now, let's continue on with this point. Remember, Bob's argument is, since Jesus asked why he was forsaken, that somehow proves that he wasn't forsaken. Now, we could do this just about every time that God the Father or Jesus asked a question, we can make this same point. Let's go back to the first two questions, perhaps, in the Bible, Genesis 3:11. Adam and Eve, you know the story. Ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And they were trying to figure out how to clothe themselves. And he says, God said to them, he asked them, who told thee thou wast naked? A question. Hast thou eaten of the tree wherewith I have commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat? Now, does this mean God didn't know the answer to those two questions? Doesn't mean that at all, does it? Bob, you don't conclude that, do you? But why do you conclude over Matthew 27:46? Just because it's got a question mark behind it, it means it's not true. Now, more to the point than the last question. Does this prove Adam had not eaten of the fruit? Now, Bob's reasoning is because Jesus asked this in a question, why have you forsaken me? That proves he wasn't forsaken. Then, according to that logic, since Jesus said, have you eaten of the tree? That would prove Adam hadn't eaten of the tree because he asked it in the form of a question. Now, remember, in the backdrop of this is 31 times in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Jesus asked why somebody did that. And everybody in this room will agree that every time they did it, except Bob says, Matthew 27:46, they didn't. Then how does Jesus asking why he was forsaken prove that he wasn't forsaken? I'd like to know that. Now, here's what I meant by this would apply every time. Jesus asked a question in the Gospels, I'm thinking at least dozens of times. And doubtless, he already knew the answer every time. Every time. I can't think of a single case in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John when he asked a question that he didn't already know the answer. Remember? He was omniscient. He knew everything. There are a few things, like he didn't know when his second coming was going to be, but he knew the answer to every question. And dozens of times, he asked a question, but he knew the answer. So why would you conclude that he didn't know the answer to Matthew 27:46? And because he should have known the answer, therefore it's not true. No, Bob, the Bible is true. Whether Jesus asked it in question form or statement form, it's still true. And then Bob said, and this is a significant argument on the side of those who don't believe Jesus is forsaken. I'm glad that Bob brought it up so we can reply to it. In John 8, 29 and 16, 32, and we're going to show 16, 32 on the next chart. Basically, the Father says to Jesus He would not leave Him alone. And you see, and this is why it's good to have debates. Because you could see why Bob thinks this might contradict Matthew 27, 46. He says twice, I will not leave you alone. And then He says in Matthew 27, 46 that He was forsaken by the Father. It seems to be a contradiction on the surface. But what Bob is doing is he is doing what we preach against all the time. He's arraying one passage against another. When we teach you've got to be baptized to be saved, the Baptist will say no. The Bible says you've got to believe to be saved. They're arraying one passage against another without trying to make both of them true, to reconcile them. You see what I'm saying? Bob, the argument you're making here is exactly the same argument as the once saved, always saved Baptists make in debate with me. They like to use Matthew 28, verse 20, where Jesus says, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world, they array it against passages that clearly teach once saved, always saved is not false. Because He said, I'll be with you to the end of the world. And they conclude, once you become a Christian, Jesus is going to be with you to the end of the world. There's no way you could ever do anything for Him not to be with you. That's the argument. They're arraying one passage against another. They're not right about that, are they, Bob? So our procedure has always been if two verses seem to contradict one another, we don't say one is right and one is wrong, and that's in effect what you did, Bob. We find a way that both of them are right. Now let's do that, okay? Here's John 16, 32. Let's notice that. Here's one of the passages where God said, I will not leave you alone. Well, actually, I think it's Jesus talking here. Behold, ye shall be scattered, every man to his own, and shall leave me alone. He's talking about His disciples. And yet I am not alone because the Father is with me. And Bob is right. That verse, along with the other one he gave, proves that the Father would never leave Jesus alone. Now, I want you to notice the distinction here, okay? John 16, 32 shows Jesus was left alone by His disciples in that they scattered. And that's how God the Father would never leave them alone. In that they scattered, not that they would never break spiritual fellowship with Him. In other words, here's what I'm saying, Bob. Peter and them scattered. They left Jesus alone. But did Peter break spiritual fellowship with Jesus? Of course not. That didn't have anything to do with what Peter was thinking. He didn't break spiritual fellowship with Jesus. He left Him alone in the sense that he withdrew his what we call moral support, or we might say support morale-wise. They're two different things. Peter left Jesus alone. He withdrew his moral support. He was scared to death, but he didn't think, I'm going to withdraw spiritually from Jesus. He didn't do that at all. Not at all. So what we're talking about in Matthew 27:46, when God forsakes Jesus, He's talking about spiritual fellowship. He's not talking about that He would do like Peter. He is talking about that. He's saying, I'm not going to leave you alone like Peter left you alone. But Peter did not withdraw spiritual fellowship. I'm going to illustrate this because I know I'm not making myself very clear at all. But I think these illustrations will help clear up the matter. I grew up a Baptist. My dad and I were close. Never could convince him to obey the truth, so I never could have spiritual fellowship with him. But I never left him alone. Never. We were always together. We were always real close. He, as we would say, he was always there for me and I was always there for him. Do you see that? I never had spiritual fellowship with my father. He wasn't a Christian. By what I think the New Testament says, he was a good Baptist. But I never left him alone. Here's another illustration. Suppose a woman, a young lady, marries a non-Christian man against God's wishes. Can she have spiritual fellowship with that man while she's married to him? No, he's not a Christian. But can she leave him alone? No. She has to separate herself spiritually. She can't have that, but she can't leave him alone. She can provide all the moral support she should, like secular ways, like his job and everything else. Do y'all see the difference? The woman, the wife in that case, cannot have spiritual fellowship with her husband, but she does not leave him alone. When the Bible says that the Father will not leave Jesus alone, it's talking about that. The moral support. He's going to be there for him, as we say. I'll be there for you. I'll back you up. It doesn't have anything to do with spiritual separation. Else we have a contradiction in the Bible, and we know that's not true. And then I tried to write this down the best I could. I didn't get it exactly right. Bob's argument next was Jesus was not really having a conversation with the Father in Matthew 27:46 or a prayer. Jesus quoted Psalms 22:1 only to describe how it appeared to onlookers that they would think He was forsaken. Let's deal with that. First, let's look at the rest of the times that things are quoted in Psalms 22:1. The rest of the time, besides verse 1. Psalm 22, verse 6 says, "I am a reproach of men." Was that just reference? Is that, Bob, was that really fulfilled by Jesus? Really fulfilled by Jesus? But what about it, Brian? Was that fulfilled by Jesus? 22:7, shoot out the lip. Didn't people really shoot out the lip in Matthew 27:39 and following? 22:7, shake the head. Isn't wagging their heads? I think that's kind of funny. In Matthew 27:39, a fulfillment of that? I believe we all think that it is. 22:8, he trusted on the Lord that He would deliver him. Let Him deliver him. Didn't they really say that in Matthew 27:46? Or were they just alluding to Matthew 27, but they didn't really fulfill it? In Matthew 22, Jesus thirsted. You'll see the exact wording there in Psalm 69, verse 21, which is talking about the same thing. That was fulfilled in John 19:28-30. In Psalms 22:16, they pierced my hands. That was fulfilled in Christ. John 20:25. Psalms 22:18, they part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture. That was fulfilled in Matthew 27:35. You see, in every case in Psalms 22 where the New Testament quotes it, none of the times, Bob, is Jesus just alluding to the verse, just trying to call somebody's attention to it, and not fulfilling it. Every time in Psalms 22, when He quotes it, He is fulfilling the verse. And that's why your position is wrong, that he's just alluding to the verse, but not really fulfilling it. He was fulfilling Psalms 22, verse 1. He was forsaken. Let's look at some other passages very quickly. This is answering the argument Jesus was just alluding to, but not really fulfilling Psalms 22:1. Let's look at other cases. For example, Matthew 2:15 quotes, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." Wasn't the very point that Jesus was fulfilling that? And not just alluding to it, but He was fulfilling that. Acts 1:20 quotes Psalm 69:25 and 109:8. "It is written in the book of Psalms, let his habitation be desolate, and let no man dwell therein, and his bishopric let another take." That refers to Judas's demise and the choosing of a new apostle to take his place. Bob, was this a case of fulfillment, or were these verses in the New Testament just alluding to those verses? Or were they really fulfilling it? How about Hebrews 8:8-9, quoted Jeremiah 31:32? "For finding fault with them, he saith, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord." Was the writer of Hebrews just kind of alluding to Jeremiah 31, just calling attention to it but not fulfilling it? Or was he saying that it was fulfilled? Why should Matthew 27:46 quote Psalms 22:1 be any different? Jesus is not just calling their attention to that verse. He is fulfilling that verse. Isn't that the way prophecy and fulfillment of prophecy works? Let's look at some others. I'm not going to read all these, but here's four more cases where the New Testament quotes the Old, and in every case, it's not just alluding to the passage, but it's showing fulfillment of the passage. Here's four more. I believe we could go on and on with this point. Here's three more. I'm confident, Bob, we could show dozens of cases where Old Testament prophecy is fulfilled in the New. Can you find a single case, other than Matthew 27:46, which you think is that way, can you find a single case in the Bible where prophecy is just, you see it in the New, and it's just alluding to that verse but not fulfilling it? Can you find a single case like the one you've done? I suggest, I haven't found one, there are dozens and dozens of places where the New Testament quotes the Old, and every place it's saying, this is fulfilled. Not just, go look at that passage, but it's not fulfilled. Like you think Jesus is doing with the audience flowing. Go look at that passage, but I'm not fulfilling this. No, Jesus is fulfilling it. It's consistent. That's the way prophecy and fulfillment of prophecy works. I don't know if we'll have time to do that, but this chart will establish beyond any doubt that yes, Matthew 27:46 is a quote of Psalms 22:1, but not just a quote. He's not just saying it just for the benefit of the onlookers. Jesus is actually talking to the Father. We'll get to this chart in my next speech, but in all 15 cases in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John where Jesus addresses the Father, He's actually talking to the Father, praying to the Father, whatever you want to call it, and the thoughts expressed are His personally. All 15 cases in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when He addresses the Father, He means what He says. He's not just calling somebody's attention to a passage, but He's talking to the Father, and what He says applies. Those are His personal thoughts. He's praying to the Father. And that's the same way it is in Matthew 27:46. Thank you very much.